Captain Henry Evelyn Harper Platt continued. On active service. Letter, September 16, 1914. This is the second day, as regards ourselves, that there has been a distinct lull in the proceedings. We have plenty to eat, plenty of sleep, plenty to drink, et nos chevaux aussi. This is September 16. September 2 papers, The Times, has just come to hand. It certainly seems decidedly panicky. You know the situation too well to be hoodwinked into thinking things other than what they really are. Namely, that the Germans are strong and will take a night lot of beating. Yesterday, from the nature of things, we were unable to participate in the battle and rested in our billet. We were on the forward slope of a long valley. Right up the valley, the German shells were falling as far as the eye could see. But as far as I could see, very little damage was done, as the fire was unaimed, and the law of average is a consoling factor. This war is such a big thing as to make one's own miserable self feel exceedingly small, and one's efforts of little avail. The great thing, as regards the individual, is to know when to expend energy. There are thousands of little things that seem to need one's special attention, and in a day of 16 hours or more, it is impossible to be on the go all the time. To come down to one's own little affairs, tell John Evelyn, if he ever goes into the cavalry, that the chief thing to teach his men is to take an interest in their horses in peace. It seems to me our system of supervision by sergeants and officers is impractical in war, and if one could only manage to drill into the men's heads to give their horses as much water as they ever want, and to groom them when they took their saddles off, however tired they were, we should save a lot of horses. When we are on the go, we usually have to split up the squadron into little pieces of water, and if the men really played the game, it would be quite possible to water decently, but I am afraid the majority are quite content to give their horses one miserable bucketful. Again, when on the go, we never get in till after dark. If a man doesn't want to groom his horse, he doesn't, and sore backs are the result. Of course, this sounds stupid, but if you can imagine being on the continual go for a fortnight, chasser le renard, 7 fois par semaine, you can imagine that many horses can be lost or saved. And in war, a horse really seems worth thousands of pounds, at any rate a fit one. As to real fighting, I think peace gives you a fairly good estimate, the gutter or the reverse. As I told you, I was out in the first 2 days fighting in Belgium, looking after supplies, but from what I've seen since, this holds good. Après tout, in our fighting, with the stimulus of bullets and a horse to carry you, a man has got to be very beat before he feels it. Unless he's an horrid funk, yet do in war as in peace. Good or bad, there's not much effort about it. You do what you think best, without much conscious effort. I've been in no real big fight yet, but this applies to a bullet or two and a touch of shrapnel. It is all the other parts where effort is required. An army marches on its tummy. The art of war is maintaining the balance between the expenditure and renewal of energy, etc. To keep men and horses fit, and men in real good discipline, to keep the saddles soft, the rifles clean, the swords right, that's what requires the juice of an effort. Also to keep the men fed and les chevaux. From what I've seen of it from the squadron point of view, if an officer can fight, the men will fight all right. But the other job is the devil. No matter how good the officer is, he cannot do the job unless he is lucky enough to have good subordination. Moi, qui vous parle, I wish I could help the splendid little Alphonse, Major Parsons mentioned in dispatches more, but the very fact of having the squadron so split up at home tend toward the sergeants not knowing their men here or their capacities. On the whole, the men are splendid, all of them to fight, but as I say, it's in the preparing to fight that we should have started altogether, when we are CIC, no more split up units. Just let me tell you the names of one or two tales I'm going to write, perhaps if I get the time. It's not fair to Alphonse to write these things now, so we'll just write them together. 1. The rest march. 2. The territorials. 3. Supplies. 4. Dismounted parties. 5. The well. 6. Lakato. 7. Hot coffee. And lots of others. But things happen so quickly, it seems like a dream. The drage horse is sticking it splendidly and actually putting on condition. He is a selfish brute and looks after himself. Black Knight going strong. Dustman tucked up a bit with the cold. All the things you've got me, the knife, the cup, I use every day. And in my left-hand pocket is your photo and letters. In my right is J.E. and a cigarette case. This not getting letters has been hard for everybody. I hope you have got mine all right. Our fresh supports from England have just come out. The horse is priceless. The dirty Germans have just been shelling the valley all day. So I hope they'll get hammered. Just as I write, our Royal Field Artillery have filed up past our farm. They'll probably come into action in a few minutes, or perhaps, as it is getting dark, wait until morning. We have just received a letter from General Settle about Reginald. Mon Dieu, I am glad he is well out of Belgium. The Cart. This is a story of events which, although seemingly unimportant, were of vital interest to us at the time. During that strategic retirement after Mons and Lakato, which strategists applauded and at which patriots wept when they considered the inevitable results, we had not had much time for refreshments of any description. Horses and men were extremely tired and famished with hunger, though by no means disorganized. In the morning we had seen 5 columns of infantry and wagons suddenly plodding back. Infantry mixed with artillery, not nicely marching forward singing Tipperary, perhaps because it had not yet been written, but cursing the name of a certain politician whose logical point of view and philosophic utterances seemed hardly to appeal to them at the moment. There is, however, a great difference between disorganization and demoralization. Demoralization is a clap of the hand and a crowd of gibbering maniacs casting arms and equipment aside in their terror and moving at an incredible pace anywhere away from the threat and danger. These men were ready to fight, but they had been told to retire. Disorganization is inevitable to defeat or success, and the spirit remains undaunted. We had just passed through a nice fat town, through which only a few weeks previously I travelled in my motor, in times of peace. As usual, the cavalry was sent off to guard a threatened flank. Said I to my major, "We have no transport, the men have had nothing to eat, and if things go on like this, I cannot see that we ever will get anything to eat. If you will allow me, I will go back into the town and charter a cartful of food for the men and oats for the horses." He agreed. Monsieur le Maire was very complacent, and I thoroughly enjoyed that trip. First my interview with him, and then visits the various parts of the town. After visiting the municipal abattoir, corn store and bakery, and various grocery shops, I succeeded in collecting an orderly quantity of fresh meat, new bread, several cheeses, and some 16 sacks of oats, not forgetting a covered railway cart, two stout French horses, and a very frightened French peasant. We had several amusing encounters, but of these more anon. Suffice to say that about midnight we started on a lonely trek, and regardless of Huns, made a cast in the direction in which we had last seen our squadron disappearing. At 3 a.m. or so, we reached an English barricade, and taking it about a quarter of an hour to pull it down, we won through to our squadron at about 3:30. Alas, disappointment awaited us. They were already on the move, and we had barely time to hand up the bread and cheese to the men as they passed us, and our cart had to fill in with the convoy. Although I was so tired that day, as I hoped never to be again, the thought of the cart and its contents made me feel almost buoyant. The squadron were told off as flank guards to the column, but all day long I kept a vigilant eye on my precious cart and its rather pronounced bulk. The men were very cheered when told of the Hermione feast which awaited them. In fact, the majority of them were far more concerned with the thought of the approaching feed than the possibility of the advancing Hun. We met no Huns that day, however, but it was a long trek that we did, and late on that summer evening we reached one of those impossible straggling French villages that are invariably shown on the map as one long street. French maps are very different to English ones. I always imagine the French surveyor starting out with good intentions, then returning to his midday déjeuner, sitting far too long over his café and liqueur, possibly ogling some dark-eyed demoiselle, and eventually completing his map entirely from his imagination. To return to the cart, I had to visit an outpost which we held, and was forced to lose sight of my precious vehicle. True, I sent a sergeant to fetch it up, but by then it had disappeared into those ramified roads which the French map-makers always forget to put in. On returning to our little camp, I said to my servant, "Where is the cart?" He replied in despairing tones, "I can't find it anywhere, sir." My heart, already low, sank still further, and on my weary horse I set out on what I could now see was an utterly hopeless quest. After an hour's miserable riding, I at last found it behind a hedge, and although I'm not gifted with X-ray propensities, I knew in my heart that my richly filled cart was no longer what it had been. My forebodings were only too accurate. The cart was empty of everything, save a few scraggy bits of meat. I could have wept, but for the fact that I was past tears. But the gift of speech was not denied me. However, I was only met with a smile, and was told that Colonel Y had converted it into a supply wagon for the brigade. Off parade, we are all of us equal, but in the midst of war's alarms, rank or tell. I did not feel equal to a determined assault from Colonel Y. Besides, all the food was consumed, and so there was nothing for it but to collect an exiguous quantity of food from the various troops in the vicinity. But I think that was the saddest moment in my military career. 9 months afterwards, I was down at the base, and quite by chance sat down at table with several friends, some ladies, and Colonel Y. Over the third glass of port, I told the story of the cart, and I think I am almost square with the Colonel. Morale. Extract from Field Service Regulations. One of the factors which should govern the decision of a general when making his dispositions for a battle is the morale of the opposing forces. There is all the difference in the world between a dog with his back to the wall and a cur with his tail between his legs. As I rode through the flourishing town of S, things could hardly have seemed, on the surface of it, to be going worse. I met a hunting acquaintance driving the motor car of a highly placed official who informed me that no supports of any kind were being brought up on our threatened flank. In consequence, the only man in England had threatened to withdraw the entire British expeditionary force. He added that it was thought that traitors were to a large extent responsible for the position, and that things could hardly be worse. Just as in uncivilized times, news flew for hundreds of miles, far quicker than it does in these days by telegraph, so in an army, bad news and good is known almost as soon as the event takes place. Every man of the British Expeditionary Force knew there was something wrong. As I rode through S, I met several little groups of men of various regiments, and they none of them had the look of beaten men. I was surprised when one of them held up his hand and called me. "Excuse me, sir, we don't want to surrender." "Surrender?" I replied. "Who the hell's talking of surrendering? There were no Germans to surrender to, as far as I know." "Well," replied the man, "our colonel at the railway station has surrendered and has ordered us to lay down our arms." I said, "Nonsense." But all the men chipped in and corroborated his statement. "Well," said I eventually, "I don't believe it for a second, but I'll go and see, and if anything is wrong, I promise to come back myself and take charge of you." At the time, I did not understand how it was possible for an Englishman to lose control of himself, but from what I have seen since, I realize only too well that there is a breaking point for all of us. Even people in England are beginning to understand this. At the time, I only saw a very frightened old man. He gave me his horse, and I reported him to the nearest formed body. With the experience I have now, I think we could have spared that old man a great deal of suffering. I arranged with a senior officer to collect the men from various parts of the town, and the last thing I saw of my gallant private was on a horse he had commandeered from some person or persons unknown. I wish I could meet that man again. Turpitude, that which is base. Private Ballam had a blotchy face, watery blue eyes, and a weak mouth. He was not the normal type of refugee. Anyone who has been to the front knows the usual type of man who is the first to bring back bad tidings. Anyone who has been to the front knows the fiddle-faced, dark-eyed, dark-haired type who is the first to bring back news that the whole of the battalion is cut up, all the officers killed, and the enemy advancing in thousands. Private Ballam was of a different stamp, and is therefore, perhaps, worthy of study. It was a baking hot day in August. The infantry had been fighting continually for a week, but had had a chance of a certain amount of food as they stuck to the roads and so hit the towns. The cavalry, though not perhaps suffering so many casualties, had greater privations to undergo. They had been continuously manoeuvring across country, guarding the flanks, linking up weak portions of the line, working from ridge to ridge, from wood to wood, getting up earlier than the infantry, and going up into some field at the end of the day, later, as a rule, than the infantry. The horses had a certain amount to eat from the corn stooks, which were everywhere scattered about the plain, and the men had eaten practically nothing for 3 days. But neither horses or men had had anything to drink beyond an occasional mouthful, The men on the afternoon I speak of were stone cold. Stone cold, not in the manoeuvre sense, but in the war sense. So tired that it made you sweat to raise your hands to your head. The horses, poor brutes, were sticking it well, but their nostrils had become dry with thirst, and to do another day's work, they must have water. We were told off, my squadron and I, to one small well. It was a deep well, and had one bucket, which was worked by the primitive arrangement of a wheel and a long chain. As I said, the men were stone cold, which means that it was time for the officers to exert themselves. We had just watered some 20 horses, all that remained of a troop. Private Ballard had been told off to let down the bucket into the well and pull it up again. It was a damn slow job, and small as the bucket was, the ration was cut down to half a bucket per horse. Private Ballin was not working with a will, and the watery eye looked rather more watery than usual. The horses pressed up against one another to get at the water, and the men leant against their horses and went to sleep, whilst every moment the sun seemed to get hotter. The officer looked round away from the well to give an order to the next troop, and as he did so, he heard the rattle of a chain and a splash. He looked quickly back. Private Ballam's hand was suspiciously near the wheel at the top of the well. The chain and bucket were at the bottom. 60 of God's quadrupeds went waterless for the next 24 hours, and one of God's two-legged creatures had done the dirtiest trick I had ever seen, or have ever seen all the time since. "Well," said I, later in the day, "I think Private Ballam is the most low-down man I have met yet, and I still think so." We went through the retreat and the advance, and I kept my eye on Private Ballam, on his watery eye and his weak red mouth, and his hat, which was always at least two sizes too small. But he had not got a chance of further proving his mettle until some time later. Again an emergency proved him the man he was. We were back in what may be described as fat, comfortable billets. Suddenly, out of the night, came word that the Germans were almost through at a sanguinary salient, and that every man available, with the exception of absolute minimum, to be left with the horses, were to be taken a nice bus ride up to the Fretton Point at the earliest possible moment. All four troops were split up, or rather each troop was billeted at a different farm. The troops rallied in no time, but the fourth did not turn up until the last second given for the rendezvous. Naturally, at such a moment, the troop sergeant was not greeted with enthusiasm upon his arrival, and I asked his reason for the delay. "Well, sir," said he, "when the order was given out, Private Ballam went outside and came back saying he had sprained his ankle, but we all know what sort of a man he is, so I gave him a bicycle to ride. Then he said it hurt his ankle too much, so we took it in turns to push him here on the bicycle." I congratulated the sergeant, and still think he achieved a good deed. As we went up to a certain wood, bearing the very unsuitable name of the sanctuary, I was not impressed by the surroundings. The German taubes were flying unpleasantly low. The British infantry had a nasty, unsettled look. However, we completed our relief successfully, and with a sigh of relief, we watched our predecessors beat a stealthy retreat westwards through the sweet-smelling wood. I was very busy all day repairing the wood and fulfilling various similar duties, and the fate of Private Ballam ceased to entreat me. Then something brought his face to my mind, and I remembered that I had been subconsciously surprised that Private Ballam was smiling as we entered the unsavoury confines of that ill-fated wood. I thought to myself, why was Private Bannum smiling? In fact, it annoyed me as it rather looked as if he thought he had scored, whereas after being unwillingly pushed on a bicycle up to the point where his duty required him, he might have been fairly said to have been checkmated. I went round to our sergeant. Sergeant X, said I, how is our friend Private Bannum? Sergeant X very rightly blushed. I am very sorry, sir, said he, for not reporting it before, but Private Bannum had an accident with his rifle this morning. And that's the story of Private Bannum. Perhaps his mother was responsible for him, and perhaps he'll get another chance. Hot coffee. At the Battle of Lakato, the task of the cavalry body with which we were fighting was to watch the threatened flank of the infantry. As a matter of fact, both the flanks and the centre were threatened, but we were told off to watch one flank, and my part of the squadron were detailed to watch a somewhat isolated point about 1,000 yards from the main cavalry. I had formed the opinion on manoeuvres that flag wagging was a hopeless method of communication. This is, thank goodness, at last realized. But at that time, we were still obsessed with the idea that it was possible. For 3 solid hours, I had been trying, with our signalers, to get into touch with the main body of the cavalry, and had failed, if I may say so, signally. Giving it up in desperation, I had to resort to the tiring expedient of riding my tired horse every half hour or so between the general and my squadron. At last, as the horse was stone cold, I decided very rashly to risk the chance of the main body riding off, as the general had promised to let us know in the event of his departure. The men were tired, hungry and thirsty. They had consumed long ago their emergency ration, and of that strange product, the remaining portion of the day's ration was a forgotten quantity. In the background was a farmhouse to which I went. Within was a comfortable, and as they all are, sensible French woman, and without the aid of an interpreter, I conveyed to her the fact that we were hungry and thirsty. She fetched, I remember it well, a beautiful copper cauldron, and in it she brewed what I'm sure was the most exquisite coffee ever made. I have lunched in town at many famous restaurants, but never have I smelt a more delicious aroma than that which arose from the bubbling, creamy brown coffee in that wonderful cauldron. We fetched a great beaker of milk from the dairy, consuming 3 glasses apiece, meanwhile cutting up large chunks of bread, covering them with butter, and slicing off huge slabs of cheese. The coffee was ready, the milk was ready, the bread and butter, known in France as tartine, and the cheese were arranged in plump little heaps of 20. The coffee smelt overpoweringly good, and I went outside to say that the feast was prepared. As I entered the field, a corporal, with a slight impediment in his speech, dashed up to me and gasped, "The Uhlans are all round us. I left my patrol surrounded over there, and they are advancing in thousands." However, he had neither a fiddle face nor a frightened brown eye. He was not a born refugee, and on being spoken to in suitable language, went back to his patrol. Things were not going well. Evening was falling, and it brought with it a certain feeling of defeat, and looking through our glasses, we failed to discern our body of cavalry, which should have been there. I learnt later that day the valuable lesson that on a detachment, it is well to have at least 3 men picketed on the neighbouring headquarters. There was nothing for it. Rally, mount, walk, march, and the best coffee that was ever brewed was abandoned, I very much fear, to the advancing Hun.